I love these guys. It's a thrill. The last arrived just at approximately the right moment to start. So I am very, very happy to be here because this is one of the most illustrious panels I think you will ever see. I'm going to just tell you a brief bit, and then I'm going to ask them all to tell you more about themselves and why I'm so bowled over and impressed, because they are all amazing people. Kalisha, you must know pretty much so everything you're talking about, since you have a great deal to do with true crime.
Yeah.
So we will ask you to speak about that. Joe. Joe, also among being a brilliant writer and many other things in life, also handles a great deal for ITW, which he has for a long time. Huh. So we're very impressed with that. I would also say the same of Claire. Not only is she a brilliant writer, but she has also had a tremendous amount to do with the wonderful things that we've all gotten through at ITW. Moving on to Walter, who is one of our men of the hour. we will then, and I can't see from here, this is terrible. Very happy this year that we are totally recognizing all of the wonderful, wonderful things that he has done. And now I am going to truly hope, because we have not had a chance to meet before, that I pronounce this correctly. Sarah Pekkanen.
You got it.
I got it.
What are the odds?
I got it. And then our current co-president, Lisa Unger, who, again, has written amazing things. And up here, we have a group who have got my heart, because we have one of our authors, who I hope she'll keep talking about that, who's amazing with rescue animals, which most of us like dogs, and we've had a big discussion before on don't kill the dog. Yeah. Get rid of all the people you want. Don't kill the dog. Now, you may agree or disagree, but besides that, we have a lot of true crime coming at us, and we have a lot of legal expertise. Also, at the end, we'll do a little quick hand raise for we've got one free book, and if anybody else has one. And for anything that you want that they have to give away, please approach them afterwards. So I would like to start now with Kalisha telling us more about herself, and that's a pretty impressive record. So please make sure you let us know what that is.
Okay, I've been writing forever, and in a variety of forms, formats, stories, essays, blogs, articles, travel writing, and my five novels. And the true crime happened with, I was a member of Sisters of Crime, and Susan Lucci, who everybody's just a fan of, had left all my children, and so she wanted to do her next venture, and she decided to do a show called Deadly Affairs, and I just responded to an email that they were looking for commentators for that from Sisters in Crime, you know, authors who knew how to talk about motivations, character, you know, all these things that we pull from real life and put into our books. And so, yeah, I responded, and the producers wound up liking me so much that they just kept calling me to do other shows on other networks. So, yeah. But I stopped doing it because I had a case that involved children. And, you know, because you're taught, you have to get to know the cases, the detective notes, the police reports, some of the autopsy report, you know, all that. And so, yeah, it just kind of was like, okay, that was just my stopping point, because it was a very sad case involving kids, and I didn't do it anymore.
And what is your latest? What are they looking for in the bookstore?
Oh, my latest book is called Running to Fall, and speaking of summer, is down there as well. And so, yeah, these are my two books that are mystery suspense about very messy women who have, you know, fallen by the wayside in their lives, and missing women they're searching for, and all of that. And I'm very, very happy that Lisa blurbed my fifth book, which was published independently, and she was like the only one. Thank you, Lisa. Yeah, so that's the fifth book. So just messy women, unreliable narrators, dark protagonists, and twist. Very, very, very strong twist.
Joe brings his own kind of expertise into his writing, and he's an old friend, and I adore him and his work, so I will now let him.
Thank you, Heather. So I've published, I think, 15 novels. I was losing track. I think it's 15. I have written two more, which I'm working on now, two. And I generally write about an ordinary person who gets into extraordinary circumstances. That's my basic shtick. And I've written a couple of books that were sort of spy adjacent, I would say. But mostly I deal with ordinary people who get into extraordinary circumstances. I've had two movies made, one good and one bad. The good one was called High Crimes with Morgan Freeman and Ashley Judd. That was a long time ago. The bad one is called Paranoia with Harrison Ford and Gary Oldman and Liam Hemsworth. Sorry. So I've been through the Hollywood mill. I think anything else, Heather, has that summed me up pretty much?
Well, I mean, your real life, too. What have you done besides write? You've done all kinds of things.
Yeah, I've done all kinds of things. I sort of am a specialist in Russia. I've been to Russia a bunch of times. Not recently. I had a break-in at my office. I appeared on Russian TV, and I talked about how corrupt Putin was, according to my sources. I get specific. And then shortly after that, there was a break-in at my office, and they took just the hard drives.
Wow.
And then they also took the mouse, my mouse and my assistant's mouse, just to make sure I knew they'd been there. And the FBI came and investigated and said this was related to the Russian Secret Service. So I'm not going back.
And I just want to say, too, as Claire introduces herself, that I have talked to students she's had in her master class who have all told me that you have changed their lives. So beyond being a great writer
yourself. Nice. That's nice to hear, because I was just wondering how I was going to top the Russian Secret Service story. So that's nice. Thanks for that.
I wonder if it's for the better.
this is true. Yeah, did I change their lives for the better?
Oh, yes.
So I'm Claire McIntosh. I don't know if it's obvious, but I'm not local. I'm British, and I live in North Wales, in Snowdonia, on the border between England and Wales, which is also where my new crime series is set. So I'm really fascinated in that sort of that limbo between two places, and that's something I explore a lot in that book. I was a police officer for 12 years. I specialised as a riot commander, so I'm quite a handy person. If things get a bit sort of fresh at the banquet tonight, then give me a holler. I always like a good rumble. So I took a career break, about 10 years ago, I guess now, when I was working at quite a senior level, and it was just getting really hard to balance being a mum at home. And so I took a two-year career break, and I started writing, and I wrote a novel called I Let You Go. And I was just about to go back to the police after my career break, and then I Let You Go just sort of exploded. It sold a million copies. It was translated into 40 languages, hit the New York Times list, and changed my life forever. So I never went back to the police. And I like to think it's their loss.
I'm sure it is. Walter.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't. You know, I like when you say there's the writing life and then there's a real life. You know, because for me, the only real life is the writing life. I've done, you know, many not very important things. You know, I was a computer programmer forever. And I didn't start writing until I was in my mid-30s. But I love writing, and I like writing anything about anything in any genre, in any form. You know, certainly I've written a lot of novels and then a lot of other books, and then a lot of turned out to do a lot of television, stuff in a couple of movies, and one that's supposedly shooting right now in Wales, actually.
Ah, cool.
But it's not supposed to be in Wales. I mean, it's supposed to be in the United States, but they made Wales look like the United States or something. I don't know.
It's cheaper.
It's a lot cheaper, yeah. Yeah. But you know, there's very little to say about me.
Yeah, this year's Thriller Master, nothing to say about
it. But, well, you know, I mean, I write books, and then there's a lot of them. I think I published like 60 books, and, you know, I'm always doing that. But, you know, when you kind of talk about things that you do, there's nothing really to say about them. Well, I write them, you know. Writing is so interesting. I'll just say, I mean, writing is really interesting because, you know, there used to be blacksmiths, right? But people don't use blacksmiths anymore because you don't need blacksmiths. Writing is older than, you know, being a blacksmith. You would think that it would be over, you know, by now. We'd move on. There'd be something that would take the place of writing. And there hasn't. And that's the kind of the central focus of my life, is that writing is such an interesting and extraordinarily abstract thing. And to work in it and to think about it and even to talk about it, which is one of the problems I'm having right now, it's astonishing and really, really beautiful.
Aw, thank you, Sarah. Besides writing brilliant novels, tell us what you are up to and perhaps a bit about what people are going to find at the bookstore.
Oh, well, like Claire, I am very experienced handling riots and rumbles. I have three boys, so every day, that's my life. I've been writing books. I've had a lot of books rejected. My first three or four books were rejected. I was 10. Miscellaneous Tales and Poems, which I actually submitted to New York publishers, was turned down. I was also 11 when my second and third book were rejected. And I was 38 when my fourth book that I spent 3 years writing was rejected. But I have always wanted to write, and I've done different forms of writing, newspaper writing, magazine writing. I turned to fiction after having my first child. I was lucky enough to have a book optioned by Amblin, a co-authored thriller I wrote called The Wife Between Us, and was hired to co-write the screenplay. So I've been dabbling a bit more in that, which I've really enjoyed. My latest novel, and I know, Heather, you want to hear more about my work with rescue animals in India, but I'm hoping I can build that into a character question. I've got a little segue there. I think I can just manage it. My latest novel is titled Gone Tonight. It's a thriller, and probably one of my most thrilling experiences with this book was when the actress Kate Mara was hired to narrate it. And she's been in everything from House of Cards to The Martian to A Teacher. My publisher told me, we're going to send you out to LA so that you can meet her and you can listen. It was just a beautiful gift to me. And I went out and I was sitting on a couch outside of the soundstage where she was in narrating my book, and I just started to tear up and cry because it was just incredible to think, this thing we all do, you know, I'm on my couch in my pajamas, I'm wandering around in a daze, I'm talking to myself, I'm scribbling on every piece of paper I can find, and then it's kind of out there and people respond to it, and that is a really beautiful life and a really beautiful career that we have. So thank you all.
And Lisa, again,
what was the question?
You also have something going on right now in that
in the
Bend. You have a movie being filmed right now, don't you?
Well, it was in development, and now there's a writer's strike.
Oh.
So we'll see how that all goes, but that's kind of the way of it, right? I mean, it's a bumpy road, so, you know, we have a... So Confessions on the 745 was optioned by Jessica Alba and her her production team, Three Arts, and we have an amazing screenwriter. Her name is Charisse Castro-Smith. She wrote Encanto and also The Haunting of Hill House on Netflix. Yeah. If anybody recently saw that, it was quite brilliant. So she's kind of like... weirdly perfect for Confessions on the 745, and she's just brilliant. It's just a brilliant team. We have a, you know, a pilot that, you know, I wasn't sure like how that was gonna go to see somebody's reinterpretation of the work, and it was really quite exciting. And I was like amazed at how it was completely, you know, completely different in some ways, but how it managed to kind of capture the beginning essence of the story in a completely different way. Like, it was like, you know, novelists are all about words. You know, we're all about like as many words as possible. We want to get in as deep as we can, but there's so much information that can be conveyed through visuals, and I think that's something that as a writer I don't always think about. And so I was amazed to see how she was able to capture the essence of Confessions on the 745, but in a completely different way. Like the opening pages are laid out in a different way than I conceived the opening pages, and I was just very excited by that. You know, like how you were feeling, like how you teared up when you listened to the audiobook being recorded. I kind of felt that way too. Like, you know, I've been a writer all my life, and I've never wanted to do anything else. And so for me, this is just like every day I'm really aware that I'm like living this dream that I've always had. And what a gift to like be able to create something that, you know, speaks to somebody and then inspires another artist to create something completely new. So that's been really exciting.
Yep, yeah. I bet. Okay, our question. Now, of course, our panel is actually titled Flawed, Fatigued, or Familiar. So my question to you now is, how do you create your protagonists, and do you believe that the protagonists must be good for people to come around and really follow them, or do you like to do, you know, that flawed, evil person who perhaps turns good, or perhaps doesn't, and you love him because you hate him so much, or her? We'll start with you, Kalisha.
Kalisha, it's your turn.
Thank you.
I don't know if I so much... I create these protagonists. They seem to just kind of come or find me, or just like... I just meet something and I fall in love with it and want to... be with it. And yeah, but they're all good to me.
Even if they're bad.
Yes. Okay. So to me, they're all good. I love them. I see their great parts, their humanity, and that's why I'm telling the story, is I want to show these good people and maybe the bad things they've done or the bad things that are seen about them or that's said about them. And I want to leap over whatever people would think about that to show who they really are. And so to me, they're all good, even some of the really ratchet ones. So,
Joe, I guess my first question here on this one for you is, how many KGB agents have you now killed in print?
They are good bad guys, aren't they? Not as good as Nazis, but Russian KGB agents are pretty good. All my protagonists, my ordinary people protagonists, have flaws. I'm not talking about like a bottle in the drawer or anything like that, because I think we want the main character to be relatable. And not only flaws, but they all have a mission, a purpose. And I was thinking about, I was talking to a friend earlier today about the show Succession. Like, why do you watch that show when you hate everybody, you know? And I was thinking about this. There's a classic old thriller published a long time ago called The Day of the Jackal. And you find yourself rooting for an assassin. And then you find yourself rooting for the guy who's trying to catch the assassin. So what that teaches us is that if a character, if the protagonist has a strong desire, it becomes ours. And so that pulls us through, that strong desire. So I basically feel my characters have to have some flaws in order to be relatable. And they also, and most importantly, need to be driven by a mission.
Just what he said. I just think about real life. I think about the people that I know and how I, you know, some of my closest friends are also intensely irritating. There are people in my circle who I want to spend lots of time with, and then people who I only really want to see, you know, on a Saturday night. So everybody we know is this sort of multi-dimensional person. And the same applies for our fictional characters, whether I'm writing a hero, a heroine, or a villain. I think about all the victims and witnesses that I've spoken to over the course of my police career and how they weren't always reliable and they were, you know, quite often not particularly nice people. And I just write from real life, I think it's one of the I'm a very structural writer. I plan my books. I plan my novels like I'm solving a murder. It's all quite forensically detailed in advance. But I don't do that with my characters. My characters just sort of emerge. I think it's a much more fluid process for me, and I definitely don't give them a specific flaw and say, you know, right, you will be the alcoholic, you will be the one who's terrified of heights. I think that's a bit formulaic.
Walter?
Yeah. it's interesting. The question's hard for me because, like you were saying, the idea of creating a character is like, you know, it's just beyond me. I start writing. And, you know, and characters, you know, say things, think things, do things, don't do things. And from that, something develops. And what develops, I have a character, and I just want to say all about Bad. You know, I learned this a long time ago when I was reading Treasure Island. I was a kid, you know. And, you know, Long John Silver was a mass murderer. I mean, wasn't just a murderer. He was a mass murderer. He killed everybody in a boat one night. Everybody. He just killed everybody. And you love this guy. He's so cool because, you know, because he's very charismatic. You know, and it's just, you know, I mean, you know, Jim Hawkins wants him to get away. I mean, really, and it's funny, I don't really understand that. I mean, I can do it, but I don't understand it, you know. And so, you know, I'll write about a character, and I'll just say that one of my characters that pops up every once in a while is Fearless Jones, and I've written he's been in at least 8 books that I've written, and I was writing about him in the last E.Z. Rollins novel, the previous one. I'm writing a new one now where Easy gets lost in this crowd and there are these people after him. And he realizes that these people are going to kill him. And there's really not much he can do about it. But Fearless comes up out of nowhere and he just takes them out one at a time because that's Fearless. He's bad. And he takes out these people, you know, and Easy said, I didn't even know you were there. And he said, well, yeah, when I was a kid, my uncle, you know, I was about, you know, 14, my uncle would take me out and we would hunt wild boar in southern Texas. And the way we'd hunt is we'd know where they are and we'd put this bait out and you'd have a knife. You'd have a boy knife. And when the boar attacked, you had to cut its throat immediately. That was my job. I had to cut the throat of the wild boar. And I never really realized that about Fearless Jones before. You know what I mean? It's like I wrote it, and it happened while I was writing it. But it helped me, and I also think the audience, understand that character. Oh, this is who he is, partially how he became this thing, and where he was going. And I think that happens very often in my writing. I don't I'm not really aware of my characters until they start speaking, because I, you know, like I try to say all the time, a great big part of writing is an unconscious thing, which is a much larger part of my mind than my conscious one.
100%. Wow.
Sarah?
Yes, I don't know what I can add to, you know, you all have spoken so eloquently, and I agree with so much of what you said, so I am going to try. I know, Heather, you asked about this. I am going to try the segue now. So characters, you know, to me, they're best when they surprise you, when they have all these layers. Nobody's all good and bad. We all have, you know, secrets in the room. Everybody has, you know, sides to themselves that they show and they want people to see, and other sides that they hide. But because I do have a background as a journalist, one of the things I love to do is to interview people. I did that, you know, for many years professionally, and I still love doing it when I meet people, just finding out all about them. And so several months ago, I was scrolling through social media, and I saw a post about a group of people going into a well in India to save a dog that had fallen. And this is generally a very positive animal rescue site. And what surprised me was that the comments, many of them were very negative and suspicious. They said, nope, they threw that dog down there. Don't donate to them. They're going to take the money. They're scammers. This is India. And I thought, you know, how horrible. Like this, you know, and the man who was behind this rescue was patiently and kindly answering every insult. And so I wrote a nice comment, and the rescue founder and I began communicating, and I said, you know, can I Skype with you? I feel like you have such an interesting life. I want to find out what it is. And so over the series of a lot of conversations, he told me his life story. He had been orphaned. Was on the street selling fragrance sticks at a young age, was abused in every possible way. And street dogs are a huge issue in India. They are overrunning the cities, and they are treated very poorly. Cows are, you know, adored and protected. Dogs are have terrible things happen to them. There are no real anti-cruelty laws, very few shelters. And he found a family in stray dogs. He would pick them up and bring them home when they were hit by a car and, you know, left on the side of the road, and try to help them. This man somehow, with absolutely nothing, found a way to get his PhD. And he said, I've made it. You know, I'm going to get a wife. I'm going to get a job with the government. I'm going to teach. I'm going to go. I'm going to buy land. I'm going to have a house and a family. And he began to do that. But every night on his way home from a job, he would see dogs on the street, injured, starving, hurt, and he would think, you guys were there for me when I needed you. I can't abandon you. So he ended up renting land and starting a shelter. This was about maybe 6-8 years ago. So after we chatted, you know, I still had not met him. I didn't know much about him, but I did really the only reasonable thing you do when you meet a stranger on the internet from another country who asks you for support and money. I bought a ticket to India and and went in February, and was just overwhelmed by the incredible work that is being done there. Came home, and I made a promise, I will find a way to buy this land for you, because it's very expensive and their salaries are quite small, and he's renting it from somebody who is shaking him down for more money. He'll never be able to buy it. So I formed a company, India Street Paws, that I'm trying to get now into a 501c3, and my pledge is to try to buy the land within a year. And so that is, along with writing, my other passion. Rescue animals, yeah.
Lisa.
Heather. Hi. Obviously, this is a very eloquent and wonderful group of people, so it's hard to keep following these amazing answers. I've long ago stopped thinking of characters as people that I create, and started thinking of them as people that I meet. You know, I know that that's not the truth of it. I mean, I know it all comes from me, but like Walter said, like, so much of my process is deeply unconscious that I don't have a ton of access to it. You know, and every book starts with a germ, which usually leads me to a swath of research. I become like obsessed about a particular topic. And then if I think the best way I can explain it is if it connects to something deeper that's going on within me, then I start to hear a voice or voices, and I follow these voices through the manuscript. And I write very much for the same reason that I read, because I want to understand these people who are living in my head and find out what's going to happen to them. And that's how I've written every single book. I don't have an outline. It's almost as if the book doesn't, and the people don't exist until I am on the page. And I feel like I write from the inside out, that I'm, you know, it's sort of exploring character and getting to know these people in my novels the same way I would get to know people in the world. They reveal themselves to me in layers, you know, just as you meet somebody and you know something about them and then you know a little bit more. That's kind of how every character is a relationship. And I try to approach them all with empathy. I think if you don't bring empathy to your characters, then they don't tell you the truth about themselves. And the truth is that everybody is deeply, deeply flawed. And very few people who are doing dark and terrible things, you know, are acting from a place of, you know, there's not this, like, you know, nefarious criminal mastermind, right? Like, mainly it's just people who come from trauma and abuse and addiction and who are now in addiction or creating trauma in the lives of somebody else. You know, it's like all very cyclical. And, you know, so I approach each of them with empathy, and, you know, I think that that's why they reveal themselves to me and why I can reveal them to my readers. And I, you know, I love them all, even the most, you know, deranged, addicted, and murderous among them. You know, they all have something within them that, you know, I can feel or see. And, you know, even the best among them, you know, are often deeply flawed. And I think that we all, you know, we all are flawed, or we think we're flawed, and or we're very focused on what could be our flaws. If we see the flaws in our characters in the books that we're reading, then that's what makes them relatable. It's not, you know, the perfect hero or the, you know, the nefarious villain that engages us. It's the person who's most like ourselves.
I'm a little bit worried about you and the person being most like yourself as a serial killer, Lisa, but...
Yeah, well, we can talk about it.
Well, you kind of gave a bit of my next question, but I'll add a little tail end onto it so that when we get back down, you'll have something. Do you write an outline of any kind, a synopsis? Do you just start writing and see where it goes? Do you start with plot, or do you start with character? And then, have you ever written the end of your book before you wrote the middle? And we'll go back to you, Kalisha.
I don't formally outline in the way that you learn in school, but every book has a sketch, tapped out of what's... I know the big high points of every book and where I'm going with them, and I always know the ending when I start writing. I always know how it's going to end. And this last book, actually, I wrote I knew how it was going to end, but what I thought was the writing of the beginning is actually the end. It's the last chapter. So I just kind of wanted to take her back. So, yeah, I definitely sketch things out and, note cards. It's usually like a mess. Like, I'll have a CVS bag full of scraps of, stuff that came up. And then I have to put those in order and stuff like that, or rip out parts of a notebook and stuff like that. But, yeah, so... some sort of outline. Writers who say, "Oh, I don't outline," and I always say, "Yeah, you do. You just might not do it in the way that we
outline."
Yeah, in that neat, clean way. But we all, I think.
Uh-uh.
quiet, you say something.
I just looked.
You want to say something?
No.
Sir? Sure. All right. Okay. So I was on a panel a while ago with Lee Child, and we were talking about the question of, do you outline or do you not outline? And I, at that time, outlined all of my books, and Lee said he just doesn't outline anything. He just starts, and every day leads on to the next, and the next, and the next. And he said, Joe, why don't you try it? So I did. And the next book took me like 6 months longer than it should have, because I wrote myself into all these blind alleys, all these things that didn't work in the structure of the story. So now what I do is I do a kind of a hybrid model. I have an overview of what I want the book to be, but it's what I want the book to be, not necessarily what it turns out to be. And I'll outline maybe the first third, between the third, about around the third of the book, and stop outlining there. And I just sort of let it go where it's going to go. So as long as I end up in a place that feels like an ending, it doesn't have to be the ending I thought of when I was starting. So basically, I guess I now do a hybrid model, if that makes any sense.
That works for me.
So as I said earlier, I do outline in forensic detail, and I really struggled with this for a long time because I used to do these panels with grown-up authors who made it up as they went along, and I used to feel like I wasn't a proper writer. I used to feel like proper writers are sort of clever enough and creative enough to just do it on the spot, and I was sort of somehow painting by numbers. And it really bothered me, and I tried winging it, and I just end up with an absolute heap of shit at the end of it. So I still outline, and what's made me happier about it is, firstly, someone pointed out to me that every screenwriter outlines. Screenwriters don't tend to. I can feel Walter's eyes on me. It's really quite disconcerting.
Walter, behave, please.
Most screenwriters will outline, but also I think what I've realised is that my outline is my first draft, and it is every bit as creative as my second draft, where I'm then not really thinking about plot and structure. What I'm then thinking about is prose and character. So for me it's like the architect's blueprints is my outline, and I would never tell an architect that they're not creative, and then I move on to actually building the house afterwards.
Yeah, the thing about screenplays, I mean, screenplays are like 92% plot, and that you really have to do that. I mean, yeah, so this happens, because then, you know, because it's not reading, that you're following something that somebody else wants you to see exactly in a kind of way, and they want it to unfold exactly in a kind of way, and so you have to do that. That's why I was looking, because, you know, it's like, yeah, it's true. There's different stuff. I don't know. I don't understand any of that. I mean, my first book, I just said, it was my second book, but the first one was the same. I said, you know, I was surprised to see a white man walk into Joppy's bar. It's not just that he was white, but he was wearing an off-white suit and buff shoes and ochre, this, you know, going on and on and on. And by the end of it, he said, a lot of people are afraid of white people. He said, but I've seen enough white people die that I understood that they were just as afraid to die as I was. Now, that was the first paragraph, but it was. And I knew the whole book then. I knew the whole book right at that point. It's not an outline, and it's nowhere near an outline. But I could follow it through, and that happens very often with me. Once it was a title, as I was talking to a guy about pornography one day, and I said to him, I said, well, Debbie doesn't do it anymore, and I went, oh, hey. That sounds good, and then I discovered a story about Debbie not doing it anymore, and 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 then sometimes, you know, especially when I'm doing, you know, a mystery specifically, not necessarily crime fiction, I'm like, you know, I said, well, this happens. It never happens like that when I write the book, you know. So the outline is something, but it's not an outline. Kind of like you were saying, it's not really an outline. It's just, this is a general kind of layout of, it's not like an architect, because architects can't do that, because the house would fall down. You know, it's much more generalized, and it leaves a lot of room for discovery. Because, you know, without it, it can become very, very boring. You know, what you write. So, you know, and also the idea of like, you know, when do you write the end? You can write from the beginning to the end and still write the end first. You know, because like you're saying, first draft, okay, that's a draft, and this is the second and the third and the fourth and the 32nd. They're all drafts. And the book really moves a lot. It changes and things happen here and there. And so, you know, it's very complex. I mean, that's how I find it. I find it very complex. And at the end, if you ask me how I did it, I really don't know. My father once built a wall. You know, walls are hard to build. He built a wall, and it just stood. It didn't crack. Nothing happened to it. One day I asked him, I said, Dad, how did you do that? And he looked, and he thought, and he looked, and he said, I don't know. You know, I feel the same way about novels.
So my process right now with my editor, my process has evolved, is that I send her a synopsis. I kind of pitch her an elevator pitch, a couple lines on the book, and then I'll write my synopsis. So it's the last one I did was 4.5 pages, and it reads maybe kind of like the back cover of a book, you know, jacket, but, you know, obviously amplified. And I do that for a couple reasons. It gives me a lot of room to change things. I don't have to stick to it completely. But I want to know up front if she's got another book with like a similar theme that's going on, if you know, by some chance, you know, the twist I'm going to do is being done somewhere else. I just want to make sure that I don't invest a lot of time in something that could become a problem down the line. But the synopsis does give me a lot of, of room, and I will sometimes change bits in there, you know, as I go. But in terms of, like, you know, outlining, one thing that I actually learned to do kind of early on, I can't remember how, it was probably one of the writing books I read recommended this, but I took books that I admired and I took a stack of post-it notes, and with every chapter I read, I would write a post-it note with like just a line describing what had happened in that chapter, and then I would put it up. And by the end of the book, I had the architecture of that book. So it's like reverse engineering, but you can see how that author laid it out. And just by deconstructing it in that way, it became less intimidating to me. So there you go. If that's helpful to you guys, feel free to use it.
There are two words that terrify me more than any other words, and they are synopsis and outline. I do not like to be told what to do, not even by myself. And I write, like I said, for the same reason that I read, because I want to know what's going to happen. When I sit down to write, I don't know who's going to show up day to day. I don't know what they're going to do. I'm not 100% sure even what my book is about. I definitely don't know how it's going to end. If I knew how it was going to end, I absolutely could not write it, because why? Why would I write it? I already know how it's going to end. So that's kind of been my process for maybe forever, you know, like since I was a kid. But I like something that Kalisha said about how, like, if you don't think that you're outlining, you really are kind of outlining, because, like, I always feel like that first draft is just for me. Like, that's the place where the story develops, right? And that's where, you know, I very freely create my characters, my story. You know, I let things evolve. I, you know, it's kind of like a gardening thing. A seed is planted, and then it, you know, the tree grows, and you kind of trim, and you give it art, you know, light and air, and then finally there's actually something alive there. And so, like, that's just sort of how I've always approached that first draft. But then, of course, you know, when that's done, I have to go back and read it, you know, and that's where my second draft takes place. And that's where I start to ask questions like, have I brought my reader with me? You know, because you can all say like, oh, I just write for myself. I write in a room and it's like so romantic. I'm like a writer. But we're not writing just for ourselves. We're writing for our readers. That is, you know, the reader experience is a big part of the writer's experience. You know, it's a relationship. And so in those continuing drafts, and even before I turn them into my editor, and then there's, you know, more drafts again, I think that there's another developmental process that happens there. And so that first draft it doesn't seem like it's an outline, but maybe that is what it is, you know, and it just takes me, you know, 6 or 7 or 8 months to write that outline. And then the next two, you know, the next few drafts go a lot faster. And that's sort of how I've written every single book. And I also think too, like something that Claire said, how she felt like because she outlined, she wasn't a real writer. I think that's not true. I think you don't choose. You either are you have the kind of mind that needs that structure, or you have the kind of mind that doesn't want that structure, that you need to, and whatever works for you is real. It's what works.
I'm just going to throw this in real quick because none of you guys did. I do outline, but I outline for a very specific reason, and that is because I have 5 children, and I started writing when the first 2.5 were born. And I learned when I got multi-book contracts that they would give you money when you turned in the synopsis and first pages. So that taught me how to draw an outline real quick. But I also agree, the hardest things you'll ever write are an outline, a query letter, you know, a synopsis. When you're looking to sell, they will be the hardest things you ever write. And the other thing I just want to mention is we've heard everybody, and I think it's wonderful because what I think they've shown us all is writing is different for every human being out there.
100%.
And for some, one thing is going to work and for something else. So it's great to be able to soak everything in and then keep what works for you. So we're down to the end. So I want, first of all, right after we finish this, we're going to raise our hands for the book. And then, but I want everybody to go, we're going to start with Lisa this time. We're going to go down the line so that everybody can say, give a little bit about what you have in the bookstore so that when people come to see you, they will know what they're looking for.
Okay, I think I have a couple of things in the bookstore, but I'll talk a little bit about Secluded Cabin Sleep 6, which was my 20th novel, which released in November. And so it's about 3 couples that head out to, take a guess, a secluded cabin, and they're hauling with them a ton of baggage in the form of secrets and lies, and there is a storm brewing, and cell phone service is spotty, and out in the periphery, there's somebody watching, and that person is running a dark agenda of revenge. So, what could go wrong? Bum, bum, bum.
Love that. Yeah, so my upcoming novel, Gone Tonight, will be until August 1st, but I think my most recent one, which is a co-authored thriller, The Golden Couple, is out there in the bookstore. And so The Golden Couple is the story of a very unconventional therapist. She's actually so unconventional that she's had her license revoked because her techniques don't really, you know, fit along with the you know, prescribed techniques. So basically what she has, her system of therapy, is if you come see her, she will assess you. Whatever problem you bring through her door, whether it's childhood issues, an issue with your marriage, job, if she knows she can fix you in 10 sessions, she will take you on as a client. But here's the trick, you have to do everything she says during those 10 sessions. And there's an arc to them. They always begin with a confession. There's an escalation. Every session has a name. So walking in through her door is a DC power couple, you know, they're beautiful, they look perfect, they're the couple everybody hates because everything in their life goes so smoothly. They walk through the door, the wife has a confession, and it goes from there.
Mm. Mm. Love
that. Do I get galley?
She wants a galley.
That one's already out, actually. Okay, I've got a copy.
Yeah, I have two books. I have one book called Every Man a King, you know, which is part of the series, Joe King Oliver. And it's, and Joe gets, he's representing, you know, this alt-right guy who's been arrested kind of illegally, and he's in Rikers Island. And he's trying to, no, he's not trying to prove it, he's just trying to find out whether or not he's committed the crimes that he's blamed for by the government, and whether or not the government is, you know, involved in it. And of course, there's a lot of problems because, you know, it's not his kind of guy, you know. And it's that story of kind of, you know, like going through that. And also the guy who's hired him, this billionaire, why did he hire him? And so those are the two things going on, you know, in the story. And that's a lot of fun. And then I have a book coming out in November, I think, maybe it's October, and it's called Touch. It's coming out from Grove Atlantic. I guess I'll call it science fiction. It's not exactly that. It's just this concept that at every time that there's the Big Bang, there's these beings who exist for a very short period of time. They remember everything that went on before, and they make a judgment on what's going to happen next. And they've decided that the greatest threat to the general universe is the chromosome, and they have to do something about the chromosome. And so those are my two books.
Sounds great. Right, thanks.
So I've got in the bookstore The Last Party, which is my latest novel. It is set in North Wales on the border between England and Wales. There's a lake. On the Welsh side of the lake is a very small Welsh-speaking community, very much like the community I live in, where Detective Constable Fionn Morgan lives. She is 30. She's a bit of a nightmare to work with. She's not remotely based on how I was as a police officer. And on the English side of the lake, there's a very, very exclusive resort of holiday cabins. There's a New Year's Eve party on the English side of the lake. Some of the locals are invited, some gate crash anyway. The morning after, during the New Year's Day swim, a body floats through the water from the English side to the Welsh side. So Fionn Morgan is thrown into an investigation with her English counterpart, Leo Brady, who is hot, because I think if you're going to write about a man for a year, you might as well make him hot.
I am so into my new book right now that I've kind of forgotten what my last book was about. I hate to admit that, but I'll tell you, the last book is called House on Fire. It is number 4 in my Nick Heller series. It involves a very rich family that makes opiates and has profited from them. And it starts when Nick learns that one of his army buddies has died from an overdose, and he decides to get to the bottom of things. Not based at all on the Sacklers or anything, I swear.
So my last book, Running to Fall, is about a couple that moved to a very, very elite suburb from Chicago, and they are the only black couple, one of just a few, in the whole community. And just as they're kind of getting adjusted and settling in, they're like a media power couple. A body washes up in the river of the town, and so that sends the whole town into a kind of frenzy, and the main character, Tragedy, is hiding a drinking problem, and her husband's hiding secrets and things like that. So,
okay, we're going to go with quick hand. First hand I see. I know we're done. I know I'm finishing. I promise. There, your book. She gets your book. Okay. And then after that, I just want to say thank you all. I think listening to the experience and everything that you have put into your work is fabulous. So I would like to thank our panel very much.